Completion of our series in the Gospel according to Mark, in which Jesus has revealed himself as Messiah, Son of God, and the God who comes close to leaders, as he was betrayed by one of the 12 that he had specially chosen as his disciples, as he was abandoned or denied by all the rest of his chosen 12, and condemned by the ruling Jewish council. Jesus steadfastly, through all of that, followed God's purpose to redeem his people and a new Passover and to establish with them a new covenant promised by God through the prophets. Now, despite all appearances to the contrary, God's sovereign plan will now continue to play out and come to a dramatic climax in Mark 15. Since under the Romans, the Jewish authorities didn't have the right to execute capital punishment, Jesus' trial before the Jewish council in Mark 14 last Sunday was actually a hearing to confirm Jesus' guilt and then prepare a case against him to be able to take to the Roman governor. Now, having affirmed before the Jewish council that, yes, he is God's Messiah and the Son of God, and consequently being charged with blasphemy, Jesus is now brought before the Roman governor, the governor Pilate, and a political version of that charge, that he claimed to be king of the Jews. Now, you may wonder, what's the difference between Messiah and king of the Jews? Not really anything, but in terms of how the Romans viewed it, that was a little bit of a difference there. They didn't care about the religious aspects of it, just the political. In Mark 15, in verses 1 to 41, our passage for this morning, Jesus' trial and his crucifixion and his death all affirm that Jesus is the Messiah, the King of the Jews, on full display as the Son of God who saves his people by personally atoning for their sin with his own death. Now, I cannot get over how an incredible thing that is. And as we've been going through the Gospel of Mark, that has been just driven in on me more and more, just what an incredible thing Jesus did for us through the crucifixion. And though the crucifixion and the death are watched from a distance by his faithful followers, or at least some of them, what they see and what we will see is the astonishing climax of God up close. We think often in terms of the resurrection, but in terms of this, God up close, you do not get any closer. You cannot get any closer. God can't to this earth than on the cross. And hopefully by the time we're done, you'll see why. Jesus' trial affirms that he is the King of the Jews who is innocent of evil. Mark chapter 15 and beginning with verses 1 and 2. As soon as it was morning, the chief priests held a consultation with the elders and the scribes and the whole council, and they bound Jesus and led him away and delivered him over to Pilate. And Pilate asked him, "Are you the King of the Jews?" And he answered them, "You have said so. You have said so." The Jewish council delivers Jesus, the King of the Jews, over to Pilate. This formal transfer of Jesus from the council of Jews to the Roman authorities, once the council had condemned them, is exactly what Jesus had said would happen to him. He told the disciples, remember, three times on the way to Jerusalem, that this is exactly what would happen to him. Mark chapter 10 and verse 33, a week before this time here, Jesus had told them shortly before they entered Jerusalem, "See, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him over to the Gentiles," to the non-Jews, to the Romans. Now, Mark doesn't state the specific charges here, but Pilate's question in verse 2 pinpoints the central accusation. "Are you the King of the Jews?" You see, under Rome, if you're claiming to be a king, you're in rebellion against Rome because only Rome sets up any kings. That's the way it went in those days. And there were many pretenders that ended up on crosses before Jesus was there. The council had condemned Jesus a blasphemy in claiming to be the Messiah with a uniquely divine relationship to God. But the religious element of this would have meant very little to Pilate. And so the title King of the Jews is stripped down. It's a political version for Roman consumption here. The charge is sedition, fomenting rebellion, not blasphemy, against Rome. And in his claim to be king, they don't mention anything about a divine Messiah here. And that's what will be repeated throughout the trial and crucifixion. Jesus, the King of the Jews. The King of the Jews. Jesus answers Pilate in the affirmative. You have said so. But this is a qualified yes. Yes, I am, as you have put it, the King of the Jews. But this is the implication here. But your idea of kingship is quite different from mine. And we know that's exactly the case. But only Rome could appoint or remove kings. And so with Pilate acting on Rome's behalf here, that becomes the charge. Jesus is the King of the Jews. And since Rome viewed the chief priests as the official leaders of the Jewish nation, in verse 3, they take the lead, the Jewish leaders do. They take the lead in making the accusations, and lots of them. Mark doesn't say what they were. His concern is he just wants us to know that there's lots of them. And to these, Jesus gives a much different response than he does to Pilate's question or to the high priest's question earlier when he was meeting with the Sanhedrin or the council. Verses 4 and 5. And Pilate asked him again. Verse 3. And the chief priests accused him of many things. And Pilate asked him again, "Have you no answer to make? See how many charges they bring against you?" But Jesus made no further answer, so that Pilate was amazed. Jesus stands silent before his accusers, just as he had stood silent before the Jewish council, except for the one question that the high priest had asked him, "Are you the Messiah?" That Jesus will answer very affirmatively. Once again, the servant of the Lord who was foretold in Isaiah 53:7 is in view here, where it says that like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and like a sheep that is before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. That whole Isaiah 53 is looking forward to the suffering servant who will come 700 years before Jesus came. It's fulfilled to the T. Pilate is amazed at what Jesus is doing here or not doing here. He's baffled that Jesus refuses to defend himself against all the many charges they brought against him in spite of his evident innocence. These are bogus charges. Pilate can see through that. Why would Jesus do such a thing? That's what Pilate is saying. He's amazed at it. These charges could be wiped away. You could go free. But Jesus makes no response. See, really, Jesus is in charge here. It's a time to speak and it's time to be silent. This is a time for Jesus to be silent. Verses 6 through 11. Now, at the feast, he, referring to Pilate, used to release for them one prisoner for whom they asked. And among the rebels in prison who had committed murder in the insurrection, there was a man called Barabbas. And the crowd came up and began to ask Pilate to do as he usually did for them. And he answered them, saying, "Do you want me to release for you the King of the Jews?" For he perceived that it was out of envy that the chief priests had delivered him up. But the chief priests stirred up the crowd to have him released for them Barabbas instead. The crowd rejects Jesus, the King of the Jews, for Barabbas, the insurrectionist, the rebel. Releasing prisoners on special occasions to gain some political advantage was a common practice in the ancient world. It was quite common. You see, it was a good way to make political gains. Pilate's practice here stems from the annual Jewish request to the Romans at Passover time. "Release us, please, one of the prisoners." But I want you to note two things about the way Pilate handles this. First, when he offers them Jesus in verse 9, note how Pilate identifies Jesus. "Do you want me to release for you the King of the Jews?" Does that strike you? It's not one who claims to be the King of the Jews. is the King of the Jews. Pilate here is treating him as though he is King of the Jews. Now, he's mocking the Jews by doing this. That's his intent here. Pilate was known for that and doing things and sideways and around the back door and other ways of jabbing them and mocking them. He was not a very nice character that way and didn't ingratiate himself to people, and he ended up losing his job here some years later. But in doing what he did, Pilate is unwittingly declaring Jesus to be king over the nations as well. He had no idea he was doing that, because in the Old Testament, in the understanding of the Messiah, of the Jewish king that would come, that king, that Messiah, would also rule over all the nations, including Rome, or whatever might be left of Rome. Second, in verse 10, it gives us Pilate's reason for seizing this opportunity to release Jesus. He sees through the chief priests, and he knows that they've delivered Jesus over to him out of envy of this immensely popular teacher and miracle worker. We've seen this tension between Jesus' popularity and their envy all throughout the Gospel of Mark here. And now Pilate sees it firsthand as well. We beat him to it. And he recognizes it for what he is. Pilate's no fool here. He can see through these things. He's got lots of experience of this. He's a survivor. But the crowd wants something that Pilate evidently didn't expect. In verse 11, they call for Barabbas instead. Barabbas appears to have been a kind of a local hero in the resistance group that opposed Rome. There were several, and they were part of a network. But he's in jail and through a recent disturbance, and Pilate is kind of thrown by this. But note that Barabbas is not their default position here. They have to be stirred up by the chief priests to go there, which they end up doing with a vengeance. Now note how Pilate again identifies Jesus in verse 12. Then what shall I do with the man you call King of the Jews? He's still concerned about getting Jesus off. He knows he's innocent. But note what he says here. Then what shall I do with the man you call the King of the Jews? It's making the knife in a little bit further there. Not the man who claims to be King of the Jews, but the man you call King of the Jews. Again, Pilate is mocking them. And once again, he's also identifying Jesus as the King of the Jews, as the crowd had an effect done just a week before, or a little less than a week before, as Jesus entered the city to great acclaim. But that was then, and this is now. Verses 13 to 15. And they cried out again, "Crucify him!" And Pilate said to them, "Why? What evil has he done?" But they shouted all the more, "Crucify him!" So Pilate, wishing to satisfy the crowd, released for them Barabbas, and having scourged Jesus, he delivered him to be crucified. He delivered him to be crucified. Pilate delivers Jesus, the King of the Jews, over to be crucified, though he's innocent. In verse 14, Pilate asks his third question in response to their call to crucify him. Why? What evil has he done? The crowd has no interest in debate here, and so they shout down Pilate and calling for Pilate to crucify him. The campuses are not going to jump on the people here. This was done ages ago. When he didn't want to debate, you shouted him down. So Pilate, his goal shifts from trying to save Jesus to satisfying the crowd so as to come out ahead politically himself. He's looking after himself here. And as prisoner releases were supposed to do, that's what this seemed to do as well. He releases Barabbas to please the crowd, and he delivers Jesus to be crucified after scourging him, and that pleases the religious leaders. Pilate gets a twofer for this. Politically, it's a double win. But before the court of heaven, it's a double indictment. See, what's happening here is that it's not Jesus ultimately on trial. It is the Jewish leadership. It is the Roman leadership and those that follow them. Pilate delivers Jesus, clearly over to crucifixion, clearly recognizing that he's innocent. In verse 4, he had asked Jesus why he wasn't responding to the trumped up charges against him. In verse 9, he tries to release Jesus in the Passover release program that he's got because he knows that the charges are baseless. And in verse 12, he expects the crowd to ask for Jesus because he knows there's nothing there. And in verse 14, he asks, why? What evil has he done? He sees none. Yet in an act of rebellion against the Lord and his anointed, this is what it boils down to. In an act of rebellion against the Lord and his anointed one, to use the terminology of Psalm chapter 2 and verses 1 to 3, the governing bodies of the Jewish court and the Roman governor have joined together to officially reject God's Messiah. And remember, Pilate has been calling him the King of the Jews. And mockery, yes, but it's real. It's real. It demonstrates humanity's supreme sin and establishes our own corporate guilt here, because these were representative of the peoples and others joined in on it. Jesus' crucifixion affirms that he is the King of the Jews who saves his people. He's not only innocent, but he's the King of the Jews who saves his people. The Roman soldiers had severely scourged Jesus with a whip of leather cords and pieces of bone and lead and glass that were embedded in the cords. And I'm not going to go into details because of the crucifixion and all that, because it'll make you sick. Makes me think about it. I don't understand how anybody could have watched it, but they did. It was a public thing. But with these whips, with the cords that they had, they ripped not only through the skin, but through the muscle tissue and through to the bone of Jesus our Lord. This was to prepare him, mind you, for crucifixion. And often, those that got scourged like this would die before they got that far. The soldiers mocked Jesus as the King of the Jews, verses 16 to 20. And the soldiers led him away inside the palace, that is the governor's headquarters. And they called together the whole battalion, and they clothed him in a purple cloak, and twisting together a crown of thorns, they put it on him. And they began to salute him, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they were striking his head with a reed and spitting on him and kneeling down in homage to him. And when they had mocked him, they stripped him of his purple cloak and put on his own clothes on him, and they led him out to crucify him. Now, the stuff that they were doing was not just scattered stuff. There was a purpose to it. It was signifying things. You see, everything the soldiers do here, the faded purple military cloak that they got from somewhere, the crown of twisted thorns, the reed by which they beat his head, the mocking greeting and the kneeling and homage, taken all together, it all perversely mimics the Roman triumph ceremony in which Caesar, the emperor, would be hailed as the emperor wearing a purple robe and a laurel wreath, and holding a scepter. Then there is the further abuse here in the beating of his head and the spitting on him. It's all as Jesus foretold in Mark chapter 10 and verse 34. And they, the Gentiles, the non-Jews, the Roman leaders, will mock him and spit on him and flog him and kill him. Isaiah 50 and verse 6, prophecy years before, 700 years before, foretold concerning the Lord's suffering servant, "I gave my back to those who strike." That's the servant who's speaking here. "I gave my back to those who strike." That's the flogging. "My cheeks to those who pull out the beard. I hid not my face from disgrace and spitting." That's what they're doing here. Now note that all of this revolves around Jesus' identity as King of the Jews in verse 18 here. In their mocking, these soldiers unwittingly acclaim the truth, because Jesus is the King of the Jews. In verse 20, they reclothe him, which is unusual. You see, the ancient Roman sources indicate that the Romans normally led their victims to their crucifixion naked, and they crucified them naked. Here, however, reclothing seems to be a concession to the Jewish sensibilities regarding nudity, and it suggests that the soldiers may have left a long cloth on Jesus when they crucified him. But normally they didn't. In verse 24, the same reasons, the sensibilities there, like I said, They may have left the loincloth on Jesus. In any case, Jesus is mocked and he's abused as the king of the Jews. The soldiers crucified Jesus as the king of the Jews. Now, the victims were commonly required to carry their own cross. You probably know that. I'm sure you do. Specifically, what they carried was the cross beam on it. They carried it to the crucifixion site where it would be attached to the upright stake, or the stake that would be upright, which stayed on the site. At some point, however, Jesus became too weak as he was carrying it, for verse 21 tells us that the soldiers compelled a passerby, Simon of Cyrene, who was coming in from the country, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to carry his cross. Now, why does Mark bother to name them? That's because they were probably well known in the early church. They probably end up being believers. In fact, there's a Rufus, which may well be this Rufus that Paul mentions at the end of his letter to the Romans. In any case, verse 22, they bring Jesus to Golgotha, the place of the execution. Verse 23, and they offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. And they crucified him and divided his garments among them, casting lots for them to decide what each should take. And it was the third hour when they crucified him. Now, mark the times that Mark goes through here. We'll talk about the third hour and the sixth hour and the ninth hour. It's significant. It was the third hour when they crucified him. Now, don't forget, all of this is according to God's plan. There's nothing outside of God's plan here. The crucifixion of Jesus and the dividing of his garments in verse 24 provide the first of three links to God's afflicted one in Psalm 22. Psalm 22 is huge in what goes on here from here on in. Psalm 22, verses 16 to 18. For dogs encompass me, a company of evildoers encircle me. They have pierced my hands and feet. This is written 1,000 years before this has ever taken place here. I can count all my bones. When you're hanging on the cross, that's one of the things. You feel all of your joints and all of that. They stare and gloat over me. They divide my garments among them. For my clothing they cast lots. Now, what an incredible description of Jesus' crucifixion. If you go through that psalm, there are incredible descriptions that match what happened in a crucifixion before they ever really had that, at least in this form. It's an incredible description here. Verse 25 mentions the time as about the third hour. That's about 9 a.m. And while verse 27 here places Jesus between two robbers and rebels, I want you to note specifically the inscription of the charge against him in verse 26. What is it? The King of the Jews. Not this man said, I am the King of the Jews. The Gospel of John tells us that the Jewish leaders tried to get Pilate to change that, and he refused to. He said, what I've written, I've written. It's not that he said, I am the King of the Jews, but the King of the Jews. They crucified Jesus as the King of the Jews. As the King of the Jews, he's representing his people. As the King of the Jews, he's dying for those who would become his people. All mocked Jesus as the King of the Jews who saved others, but not himself. They mocked him with those words. He saved others, but he can't save himself. Can't or won't. Verses 29 to 32. And those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads and saying, aha, you who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself and come down from the cross. So also the chief priests with the scribes mocked him to one another. They didn't address him, but they were mocking him among themselves, saying, he saved others. He can't save himself. Let Christ, the King of Israel, come down now from the cross that we may see and believe. Those who were crucified with him also reviled him. Jesus has three groups mocking him here. I mean, it's not simply in stereo. It's in, what's the word for three things going around? Triplet somehow. Those who passed by, the first group in this trio here, in verses 29 to 30. They showed that the public who once welcomed him with great anticipation into the city just a mere 6 days before that or so, and delighted in his entertaining exchanges with the religious leaders, well, they've now turned against him. You know, those we despise those most who disappoint us the most. These were disappointed people. This is the Messiah, and they turn against him. They deride Jesus. That's a word translated in other contexts as blaspheme. And that's exactly what they're doing here. They're blaspheming Jesus, God's anointed one. They wag their heads at him in a visible sign of contempt. And they mockingly urge him to save yourself and come down from the cross. And they unwittingly fulfill God's plan in the second link that we have here in this section with Psalm 22. Psalm 22:7. All who seek me, see me, mock me, and they make mouths at me, or they cast abuse on me. They wag their heads. That's exactly what they do. And they don't realize they're fulfilling all of these prophecies. The religious leaders in verses 31 to 32 don't speak directly to Jesus, but among themselves, as I mentioned, they're congratulating themselves on finally achieving their goal of eliminating him. They acknowledge that he saved others. Of course, they can't deny that he healed people, that he cast out demons. But they mock him that he can't save himself. But I want you to note how they identify Jesus here, even if mockingly. He is the Christ, the King of Israel. They, too, consequently challenge him to come down now from the cross that we may see and believe. They want a sign. And finally, the third part of this, the two robbers who are with him, crucified with him, with Jesus, likewise revile him at the end of verse 32. Now that's getting pretty low when the ones that are getting executed with you are also mocking you, making fun of you. The irony is that it's by not coming down that Jesus fulfills his role. It's not by coming down, but by hanging on that Jesus fulfills his role as the Messiah who saves his people. How? By offering up his life as a ransom for their sin. So he's got to hang on there. He's committed to that. He didn't have to go through any of that. With a mere thought, could have wiped them all out. But no. What he set out to do and how he is exercising his kingship here, his kingship ultimately over all the universe, is by hanging on a cross in our place. Jesus' trial affirms that Jesus is the King of the Jews who is innocent of evil. And his crucifixion affirms that he is the King of the Jews who saves his people, not by saving himself, but by staying on the cross. Remember what Jesus said, if you follow me, you got to pick up your cross and follow me. He who loses his life will save it. Jesus is leading the way on that, isn't he? He's losing his life in order to save ours. And it will be his will be saved as well. Resurrection time will be coming up. Verse 33, and when the sixth hour had come, there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. It's noon. It's noon. Jesus' death confirms here, will confirm here, that he is the Son of God who atones for the sins of his people. The sun is at full strength. It's noon. And God turns the lights off here. Darkness rules from noon to 3 o'clock. Ninth hour. He rules, the darkness does over the whole land here, that is Jerusalem and Judea. It's the darkness of God's judgment. It's like the deep darkness that God had placed over the land of Egypt for 3 days just preceding the very first Passover. Remember, this is Passover time here. The very first Passover when God delivered his people out of Egypt. And now, a new Passover is being established. We've got the Passover lamb on the cross now being sacrificed. And a new Exodus are in the process. The forgiveness of sins, the liberation from those things. But the unexpected darkening of the sun at midday would have been particularly alarming here because it was a clear sign that God was weighing in on the occasion. And in this case, it's a questionable execution. And it underscored the severity of the judgment that would be coming. To pagan, Gentile, and Jew alike, the darkness would have indicated God's approval of Jesus and his disapproval of those responsible for his execution. But the particulars here point to the cosmic signs that accompany the coming day of the Lord that Jesus had talked about just a little bit early, just a couple of days earlier in Mark chapter 13, verse 24. The things that he said would mark the day of his return, the sun would not shine. It's one of those. A day of judgment for all who reject God and his ways. The time of day, the failing sun, and the fact that this is Passover, recall another Old Testament prophecy in Amos chapter 8, and verses 9 and 10. In that day, declares the Sovereign Lord, I will make the sun go down at noon and darken the earth in broad daylight. I will turn your religious feasts into mourning and all your singing into weeping. I will make all of you wear sackcloth and shave your heads. And I will make that time like mourning for an only son. Who's the only son here? And the end of it like a bitter day. Verse 34 says that at the ninth hour, 3 o'clock, at the end of the 3 hours that this threatening darkness was signaling God's severe judgment, out of that comes a terrible, loud cry responding to an even greater, deeper darkness carried by Jesus himself. Jesus' cry of abandonment under the cup of God's wrath. Verse 34. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? Jesus here quotes Psalm 22 again. There it is, verse 1. And he makes that psalm his own as he's hanging on the cross. That psalm is about God's suffering servant there as well. It says, my God, why have you forsaken me? It goes on, that verse is completed, saying, why are you so far from saving me from the words of my groanings? Now, what was happening here? What was happening? Well, Jesus was bearing our sin. He was drinking to the full the cup of God's judgment and wrath for us. He was experiencing what it means to be separated from God. Now, you've got to understand what this means in this case. This is Jesus. He lived a perfect life. He was inseparable in his relationship with God the Father. They are one, Jesus had said on more than one occasion. I'd like to read the comments here of a theologian who really captures this really well, I think. Think about this. In the moment of the Son's greatest need and greatest pain, God is not there. The Son, this is the Son of God, cries and is not heard. The familiar resource, the ultimate resource, the only resource, is not there. God, who was always there, the God who is needed now, as he's never been needed before, was nowhere to be seen. There was no answer to the Son's cry. There is no comfort. Jesus was left godless, without God, with no perception of his own sonship, unable for the one and only time in his life to say, Abba, Father. He was left with no sense of God's love, no sense of the operation of God's purpose. There is nothing but that why, trying vainly to bridge the darkness. He was sin. He was lawlessness. And as such, he was banished to the black hole where lawlessness belongs and from which no sound can escape. But why? That was the Son's only word in his final agony as he reached out to God, whom he needed so desperately, but whom, as sin, he couldn't discern and from whose presence he was outcast. There could be no accord. He had to be dealt with not as Son, but as sin. That's what's happening on the cross during that time of darkness, and it comes to a head when you get to the ninth hour, to 3 o'clock. and you have this anguished cry, my God, why have you forsaken me? Jesus in his human nature is experiencing the max, far more than what we would ever experience under any conditions. The amazing thing is that God was never more present on earth than at the cross at this time. My God, why have you forsaken me? That was blocked from Jesus, but God was there. God was there on earth as in heaven. He was there on the cross, the Son. And in agony of separation, the Son, bearing his own self, in his own self, the cost of our salvation. That was the depth of the darkness of the cross, and it's also the beginning of the light. You see, it's reached 3 o'clock, and the cloud goes away, the darkness goes away, whatever it is. Verses 33 and 34 here, I've read, indicate that the completion of the period of the darkness and Jesus' agonized cry of abandonment occur at the same time, which means that God has turned the lights back on at this point. You see, the cry comes when the max comes, but then the light comes. God turns the light on. Jesus' last cry and death and the teaching and the tearing of the temple curtain take place. Verses 37 to 38. And Jesus uttered a loud cry and breathed his last. And the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion who stood facing him saw that in this way he breathed his last, he said, truly, this man was the Son of God. Jesus' final cry in verse 37 is not the despairing cry of final anguish, but it's the joyful counterpoint to the cry of abandonment that he had in verse 34. It's the cry of exaltation. It's the cry of victory. Likely, it's the "it is finished" that's in the Gospel of John, the completion of the sacrifice. It's a loud voice of unusual strength and power, which indicates that physically he's not yet to the point of death. Surprising that it comes here. Notice it doesn't say that he dies. He does, but notice how it says it. No, it says Jesus uttered a loud cry and breathed his last. You see, he died willingly. It wasn't taken from him. He gave it at this point. Furthermore, with the completion of his sacrifice ransoming his people, in verse 38, it states that the curtain of the temple was torn from top to bottom, which means that God did it. God did the tearing here. And it indicates that a new way has been opened up into God's presence, the way that Christ has provided here with his death. And it also signals that the old ways are under judgment here and destruction, and Israel's rebellion against God. The centurion's up-close confirmation of Jesus' identity as the Son of God complements this in verse 39. You see, with the way opened up into God's presence now, what do we have here? We have a convert, a Gentile, a centurion. Now, Luke talks about the first convert on the cross. Well, this is the second one, although in Mark he's the first one. A Gentile centurion commander, the one who oversaw this whole thing. Isn't it great what God does? He takes the one who's overseeing all this, and he opens his eyes, and he saves him. It says, listen to what it says. And when the centurion who stood facing him, he was right there, as close as any human being was to Jesus when this was happening. And he saw that in this way he breathed his last, he said, truly this man was the Son of God. Now, some would translate a Son of God, but in the way Mark is going here and all this, that's meant to be the Son of God. And the centurion is recognizing something extraordinary here. And that's the term he uses for that. The centurion is up close. Verse 39, I just read here. we go on in Psalm 22. You know where that goes after the person suffers in that psalm? He ends up partway through praising God because God has delivered him. And toward the end of it, Psalm 22:27 says, "All the ends of the earth shall remember and turn to the Lord, and all the families of the nations shall worship before you." And that's as a result of the suffering that the person does in Psalm 22, the suffering that Jesus did. That's where it goes. It reaches out to the nations. The centurion's affirmation of Jesus as the Son of God here, for the first time by a human being in the Gospel of Mark, and from a Gentile, and it's totally unbidden. He's had nobody preaching to him except the example of Jesus. It means that the ingathering of the nations anticipated in Mark and in Psalm 22 has begun. Began with him. The centurion here joins with two other declarations that Jesus is the Son of God, declarations by God the Father. And God joins his declaration with his own here at the end of it all. This was truly the Son of God. In verses 40 to 41, we have some women watching at a distance, and we're going to close with this. There were also women looking on from a distance, among whom were Mary Magdalene, and Mary the mother of James the younger, and of Joseph, and Salome. And when he was in Galilee, they followed him and ministered to him, and there were also many other women who came up with him to Jerusalem. These women were looking from a distance. These are the faithful followers of Jesus, looking from a distance, as we're looking from a distance. But what did they see? They saw the cross at a distance, but they saw God up close. And they'll come to recognize and understand that in due time ahead. The cross at a distance, but God up close. Listen, God did not come any closer to us as human beings than he did on the cross. How close can you get when you bear someone else's sins? When you bear the sorrow and the pain? When you go through all of what we have gone through? God has come close. And this is a powerful revelation of that, the powerful revelation of that. The cross and what took place there. My God, why have you forsaken me? Because he came really up close to us on the cross and took the burdens of our sins. If we trust in him, put our faith in him, and follow him, let's pray. Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you for Jesus. We thank you for what he did for us. We thank you for the love that that demonstrated, but we also thank you for what that accomplished for us, for all who believe and put their trust in him. And I pray, Father, that you will help us to trust you all the more and to love you all the more. In Jesus' name, amen.